Good morning. We'll call the meeting to order of the Agriculture Policy Committee today. Have a couple of presentations and some bills on the agenda, so it should be a full agenda again. First up, we have the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association, and if everything works, I believe they have a presentation for us. So go ahead, introduce yourselves, and tell us about your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives. My name is Chris Wallum. I am the president of the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association, and with me here today are Grant and Don Breakrights from Redwood Falls area. The Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association is proud to represent Minnesota's cattle industry. There are approximately 18,000 cattle producers in our state, contributing to an industry that has an economic impact of approximately $4.2 billion and employs nearly 27,000 people. Minnesota is ranked 10th in the nation for total cattle on feed, as well as 10th in the nation for beef exports. I know we don't have much time this morning, so we wanted to take this opportunity to highlight some of our members' success from this last year and share part of Minnesota's beef industry conservation story. Like I said, next to me are Grant and Don Breakrights of Redwood Falls. This year, they were recognized on a national platform for their outstanding conservation efforts. The National Cattlemen's Beef Association, along with NRCS and Dow AgriScience, organize and sponsor the National Environmental Stewardship Award. This award annually recognizes the outstanding stewardship practices and conservation achievements of U.S. cattle producers from across the nation. Regional and national award winners are chosen for their commitment to protecting the environment, improving fish and wildlife habitat, while operating profitable cattle operations. The common trait among all winners is the desire to leave the land in better shape for future generations, while also inspiring the next generation of land stewards. So we have a video at this time showcasing their farm and their operation. I'll see if I can get it. My kids recently told me, "Dad, get used to it. Technology is here to stay." So.
Like we always say, it was working before the meeting.
We're getting there. It's not playing.
They started by splitting just one pasture in half. See how the cattle and grass would perform. This first
trial was a success, and they were soon working with NRCS to subdivide all their grazing land.
We saw what was happening out here and how the grass was performing and how things were getting better and better, and so we started splitting it down even further. And that's when we started working with the NRCS office and working into more rotational grazing, and we started attending educational classes and, you know, seeking out other people that have been doing this for a lot longer time than we have.
So we're growing grass on our hills where we never used to grow grass more than 3 to 4 inches tall. We're growing grass that'll be waist high in June.
When I started with cattle with my parents, there were pastures that it looked like a lawn, and it was very patchy on. You could see dirt everywhere. And since we started doing this, we can see a huge difference. The ground is so much richer, and the grass is so much fuller. It's coloring the ground. We don't see patches of dirt anymore.
Over the years, the Breakrights have continued to make improvements to their pastures. 14 watering facilities have been added to support the rotational grazing plan and ensure that cattle have good, clean water at all times. These changes have also had a positive impact on the naturally occurring water sources around the operation. There's less runoff to the adjoining Minnesota River, and the streams on the property are cleaner and in better shape.
So when we started with the first rotational grazing system out here, we had severe riparian damage to our creek banks, our stream banks. We noticed immediately that they started to heal, and then when we got the water tanks installed farther away and gave our grass plenty of time to rest, our riparian areas are all healed, all covered with grass, just like the main part of the pasture.
You see very few, if any, areas where it's bare dirt. The grass has grown back up, and 9 times out of 10 when I go to the pasture creek, it's running clear, and that makes us happy. And that makes the cattle happy, too.
Cattle at Stony Creek Farm also spend time grazing on public land through an agreement with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. This gives Stony Creek additional pasture land while helping the state manage the health of their land.
We know how we can manage our land, which is the same as theirs with the cattle, and I'd really like to see them manage their land more with the cattle. Most of the land management in this area done by the DNR is done with fire. We've made it very clear that our cows don't care if it's windy or raining, they're still out there managing that land.
If Grant and Don weren't here to work with us on doing this, it'd make our job, you know, if not impossible, certainly a lot more expensive. If everybody in my work area farm, like Grant and Don, our water quality and wildlife problems would probably be done real quick.
The Breitkreutzers admit they stumbled onto one of their practices almost by accident. They began planting cover crops as a means of creating additional forage, but quickly realized the all-around benefits.
We didn't really know what cover crops were. We were just using them to produce more feed for the cattle, and all of a sudden, the light bulbs started coming on. We were seeing less problems in the fields with weeds and insects, and so we just won't go without planting a cover crop now.
Last year, we did a cover crop that I think had 15 different species in there, and we had our cows out there, and they loved it. It was the most weight gain I've seen on cows in such a short period of time, and they kept it all winter, and our cows just loved it. They'd go out there just happy as could be, and they'd come back in just happy as could be.
The gates at Stony Creek Farm are always open to people that want to learn more about stewardship, including other cattle producers who are looking to improve their conservation practices. The Breitkreutz family knows their efforts will ensure Stony Creek Farm is around for generations to come.
Hopefully by doing what we're doing with the stewardship here, there will be something here for Carly if she wants, or other generations coming along, just because we've maintained the integrity of the soil, the land, the water. So hopefully the next generation's got a good chance and a good start.
Watching my dad learn about this rotational grazing and like the mop grazing and what we can do to better our environment. He is passionate about creating something that's going to last, and I've become really passionate about creating something that's going to go on to benefit our next generations, and I think that's extremely important.
It's just been incredible all over the farm. This is what God gave us. Let's take the best care that we can, and that's what we're trying to do.
What a great story. Thank you. And that green grass sure looks pretty too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Mr. Breitkreutz, just a quick question. You mentioned you're doing some grazing on state land, and we've tried to encourage that with the DNR, and had some issues with their fencing standards. Could you talk about how you've been able to work with them, and how has that gone for you?
The way we address it with the DNR in our region is we've signed cooperative farming agreements with the DNR. In our cooperative farming agreement, the fence is our responsibility. We are tucked in the river valley quite a ways away from major highways, so we just get by with a poly tape or a single wire in our management areas. You got to understand that a lot of the ground that we manage for them is it's about 1,000 acres, and we'll go in and do 35 to 40 acres at a time. So if we do happen to have a problem, we're down there twice a day checking them, so it's usually not an issue.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Lewis.
Thank you. Not the first time I've seen that that video, and just a great job. I was just curious about, over the last several years as you've shifted your farming practices, has that worked out for you commercially? I mean, obviously, we all got to make a living, but has it turned out to be a successful approach as far as shifting the focus on the business?
Mr. Breitkreutz, go ahead.
The The first transition on our farm was with the grazing of the cattle on native pasture lands and some newly seeded and improved pasture lands. And in the first year, we more than doubled the production. And in over the period of probably 5 to 7 years, we've taken our operation to, instead of grazing 3 to 4 months a year, we're grazing 6 to 7 months a year, sometimes longer. And we're leaving more grass than we ever used to produce, which keeps the ground sheltered and protected. After learning that and seeing the success of that, we implemented it into our row crop operation. We figured if we could do it on pasture land, let's try it on the row crop. So 3 years ago, we made a commitment to 100% no-till, but we incorporate cover crops in there, and we run the livestock across there. And all I can say is our production's staying the same as the neighbors, and our inputs are dropping immensely, and water infiltration rates are just climbing through the ceiling. It's just about unbelievable what we're seeing. We had a 10-inch rain event, and I think we only lost about 2.5 inches.
Follow up, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say congratulations and thank you for sharing this story. This is just remarkable, and I very much appreciate learning about it today. So thanks for being here. Sometimes it's uncomfortable to be here and to be recognized. I think you were blushing a bit during that video, and I think, you know, that. But that's the story that needs to be told, that there are farmers who are cognizant of their responsibility with us being good stewards of the land, that the majority of farmers are much like you, but they're also humble and they don't want to be recognized. So I appreciate that you came today and that you allowed us to hear your story. So thank you.
I'd like to thank you for that comment, but it was a real eye-opener to us as to what we had done on our farm when you put it on tape.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I watched that video, and I wish my wife were here. She grew up in western North Dakota on a cattle ranch. I think she would have, that's the way she perceives cattle ranching. But my question is about, and just my compliments. This is really a model and of what can be done. It's pretty really impressive. I enjoyed the interview also of your daughter and her excitement as well. And, of course, the contented cows, that's fun to see, too. But my question is more about replication and other interests, and this might be more for the Cattlemen's Association. Do you see, is there much interest in other cattlemen looking at this approach, or do you see any replication of this approach maybe in the area or the neighborhood or in other parts of the state?
Mr. Wall, I want to take that one.
Mr. Chairman and representatives, I do believe cover crops especially are a growing interest to the farmers and especially to the cattlemen's. It gives us another opportunity to help our soil health and increase our ability to winter cows. The Brakerites have done a very good job of setting an example for us, and we are truly learning from them.
Just one more quick follow-up, Mr. Brakerite. So cover crops are usually seeded in the fall. Is that when you seed yours? And then you mentioned you graze them, and then you seed directly into those cover crops. Give us your timeline of when you establish those crops and such.
Mr. Chairman and Representatives, we went about this probably 100% the wrong way when we started out. And like was mentioned, we started out doing it strictly for forage production because we're on a limited land basis. We interseed cover crops in our corn when it's about V4, V5. That's what we're doing in the corn. So when we harvest corn, we have a green growing cover crop that's ready for the cattle and to hold the soil. We also went back to a three-crop rotation. We grow corn, soybeans, wheat. After our spring wheat is harvested, we go in with a multi-species cover crop there. We will get growth as tall as waist high. And we run our cattle across that and leave about half of that, which holds nutrients all winter. And we also plant cover crop species that will green back up in the spring to hold our winter applied or spring applied manure applications for the next growing corn crop.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions by members? Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a sense, and maybe the association does, or it's not your job to see how many places in the state this would work. And I know that an operation like this isn't movable across all of the different types of land that we have, all the different growing systems that we have across the state, but there are regions that probably are somewhat alike. I'm just curious if there's been any work about how to spread these practices and make them viable in other parts of the state.
Mr. Wall or Mr. Breitkreitz, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman and Representatives. This will work anywhere in the world. We've been blessed to work with people from South Africa. Currently, we're working with a doctor out of Mississippi. Those guys have proven it works worldwide on any soil type. The biggest problem is it's a change of mental attitude as to how you look at it. I mean, I was born and raised, you plowed everything. So that's the biggest mindset to jump over.
Seeing no further questions, is it calving time, by the way?
Yes, it is.
Okay, better get home, check those cows. Very good. Thank you so much for the message and the congratulations to the panel. We have a couple of bills up, but first one more presentation by Cooperative Network, who is with us today. Good morning. Identify yourself and proceed, Mr. Patrick.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be very brief, let folks know today's co-op day at the Capitol. Patrick Murray, I am the Director of Government Relations for Cooperative Network. We're a two-state trade group of all different sorts of cooperatives. There's a handout in your packet that has a list of all the different sectors that we work with, ranging from credit unions to dairy co-ops, electric, farm credit, farm supply, food, housing, healthcare, processing, and telecommunications. So we cover it all, and today is our day at the Capitol. So I appreciate Mr. Nisley also affording me the opportunity just to let folks know, but we have a lot of folks here that are from your districts that are going to be coming here to talk to you about issues that are of interest to the cooperative. And some of the issues, I'll just be real brief about what we're going to be talking about. It's water quality, a local democracy issue for our electric cooperatives, property tax relief and fairness for our cooperatives and their member owners. Transportation funding is a very large issue for our members as well. Credit unions have an issue that they'll be coming to talk to folks about, broadband access as well. Today is also broadband day at the Capitol, so I know there's a lot of folks in town also that will be meeting with you as well. And collaboratively, we're working with their group. And then also the Agriculture Healthcare Cooperative provision that was included in House File 1 that was signed into law earlier this session. This was a piece that was very supported by a lot of members here on the Agriculture Committee as well as members of both bodies. And we're very thankful for folks for their support. We will have some folks that are coming into some of the meetings to give folks updates on where things are at with the startup and the process for that co-op that is going to be getting off the ground here to provide health care for folks on the individual market, primarily folks that are farmers and producers. So that's what I have in a nutshell. I wanted to again say thank you. We also have a reception tonight from 4 to 7 across the street at the beautiful Kelly Inn, which is now known as the Best Western Plus Capitol Ridge, I believe. So if you're able to make it, we would love to see you. But that's all I had, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Well, Mr. Murray, thank you very much. And some of us call that place home, so that's pretty good. Anyway, so yeah, Cooperative Network Day today and the reception this evening. Thank you, Mr. Murray. Any questions from members? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, members.
First bill up on today's agenda is House File 208. Representative Bennett, would you care to move that bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be glad to move that House File 208 be referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division.
Thank you much. And before I forget, we have the minutes from the last meeting, and Representative Kunesh Padin, I think, has checked those minutes over, and all in favor of the minutes from March 9th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative. And Representative Hurdos, let's hear your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing the bill. This is also House File 1944 that was heard last year and approved through your committee and as part of the omnibus tax bill that did not become law. Members, House File 208 allows for an owner of property to immediately be removed from the Metropolitan Agricultural Reserve program upon the death of an owner or by a surviving spouse, heir, or trustee. A little bit of history, the ag program really had its origin in protecting farms and farmers from the metropolitan development and encroaching on their farms and the development patterns that would threaten their ability to farm due to the increased values of land and the resulting taxes. To prevent land speculators and investors from holding development land in the Ag Preserve program, one of the provisions was that once you're enrolled, it has to be in for a minimum of 8 years. What the bill seeks to do is provide an exception to this rule in the event that a farmer or landowner should become a decedent, and a surviving spouse or heir may not be able to continue the farming operation. And the death of a landowner is often a huge game changer in terms of the continued operation and or its economic viability. So if allowed to become law, a surviving spouse, heir, or trustee would be permitted to immediately revoke the 8-year covenant, which would enable a family to transfer or dispose of the property, employing the principle of highest and best use in the marketplace. And members, in many circumstances, if there is a death, there's often estate or trustee issues that come up, and the IRS rules often recognize that the stepped-up basis of the land must be dealt with regard to taxes. And so the IRS is usually looking for the money within a maximum outlier of 9 months, and that liability can result in a partial or complete sale of the property. So allowing a revocation of Ag Preserve in this instance would allow an owner to sell part or all of the property in order to deal with that issue. In addition, last session, the telecommunications industry came to me and asked if I would take a friendly amendment onto the Ag Preserve bill, and that was to allow the construction of cell towers on Ag Preserve land. Now, Ag Preserve status is really a metropolitan zoning, but there are three rural counties that do employ the Ag Preserve law, and that's Waseca, Winona, and Wright counties. So cell phones and the Internet, all of these telecommunications didn't exist at the time that this law was enacted. And the placement of those towers is oftentimes strategic in providing for an efficient network, and placement sometimes would be best located on the land that happens to be zoned Ag Preserve. Even today, efficient farming uses this same technology to guide GPS tractors, to plot information on the harvest data that's done on the fields, and also aids in first responders and other emergency things that use and rely on our modern technologies today. So permitting this limited commercial use on Ag Preserve lands really doesn't change the primary intent or use of the land. You will note in your packet I provided a picture of what a cell tower would look like typically on a piece of farmland. It takes a very small piece of real estate to do that. Assessors actually do assess that little piece of the land that is part of that construction as commercial use as well. And so with that, that's pretty much the bill. It wasn't opposed last year, and just wanted to meet the requirements of getting this heard and getting it referred on so that it might have a chance to become law this session. So with that, I'd yield for any questions.
Representative, I think you talked about having an oral amendment.
Yes, I did. Thank you. Members, the Senate has already heard this bill, and some of those ag senators thought it would be a good idea to amend the language. I had a 180-day provision in the text of the law that a property owner must exercise this option. The Senate changed it to 365, and I would like to, with your permission, make that oral amendment on line 114 to amend 180 to 365.
Representative Bennett, would you care to move that oral amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move the oral amendment, page 2, line 9, deleting 180 and inserting 365.
And did you all get that? Look, Mr. Sullivan, could you just go over that again and explain it and so there's no confusion?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, Representative Bennett's amendment on House File 208 is on page 2, line 9, delete 180 and insert 365. So there would be up to a year then for after the death of an owner, spouse, or qualifying person for the surviving owner to elect to terminate the agricultural preserve with the amendment.
Thank you. Representative Bly, are you okay with
that? I'm okay. I'm just wondering if the author could kind of explain the reason for the change or the advantages that would come with that and give us a little more information.
Well, I wanted to make sure...
Representative Bluthaus, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bly. I wanted to make sure when I authored this bill that the provision was acted on in a timely manner. Members of the Senate had argued that somebody who's grieving a death, having to talk to attorneys and whatnot, that oftentimes that time passes and that maybe 180 days wouldn't be enough. And so they approved that amendment when it was heard in the Senate. And the Senate author just let me know that. And I said, I don't have a problem with it. I just would prefer that it track, you know, in parallel with what's going on in the Senate. One other thing I didn't mention, in order to exercise this provision, you do have to pay the current property taxes that would have been imposed if it weren't in ag preserve from the previous year. And that's a little bit of a penalty, but I did it on purpose so that there's really no abuse of this law in terms of being in ag preserve and getting out of it.
Okay, thank you. All in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Questions from members on the bill as amended? Anybody in the audience care to testify for or against the bill? Seeing no questions, Representative Bennett, Representative Hurtado, do you have any final comments on the bill?
No, thank you. And in a manner of brevity, I have no more comments. Thank you.
And Representative Bennett, you care to renew the motion?
I will do that, Mr. Chair. Renew my motion that House File 208, as amended, be re-referred to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes and the bill is on its way. Thanks, Representative.
Thank you for hearing the bill.
Next bill up on today's agenda is House File 2049. Representative Mahoney, would you care to move the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2049 to be referred to the Committee on Agricultural Finance.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative Keel.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Your bill has been referred. Let's hear about 2049.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2049, this bill establishes a farm-to-school grant and technical assistance program to increase the amount of Minnesota-grown food accessible to kids in order to increase Minnesota's children's access to healthy and locally produced food, and also to connect farmers and processors who sell their products to schools and early care providers. The first part of the bill creates a grant program that reimburses schools and child care providers for the actual cost of Minnesota-grown food. The amount of funding available is calculated based on the number of meals served the previous year. The equivalent of 5 cents per meal will be available to schools to reimburse them for the cost of local foods. Up to 20% of the funding can be used for educational activities that directly connect children and their families with agriculture using things like school gardens, classroom-based gardening, or cooking projects and field trips to farms. The grants will be awarded on a first-come, first-served basis. It will appropriate, I know this isn't the Finance Committee, but I thought you might be interested, it will appropriate $4.5 million in 2018 and 2019 for the grant program. The dollar amount is scalable, and the bill will be successful even if it's a lower dollar amount. Right now, half the school districts do some sort of farm-to-school activities, and it would cost $9 million if every school if every school did the grant program. The second part of the bill creates 3 new agricultural extension positions at the University of Minnesota Extension. It would provide education and technical assistance to the farmers to help them sell to institutions. This is the number one item farmers have said they need. $300,000 in 2018 and in 2019. 2 of the positions must be based in a different non-contiguous extension regions outside of the Twin Cities Metro, with the third being in the Twin Cities Metro. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have, I believe, 3 testifiers.
Great. Good morning, ma'am. State your name and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Arlene Jones. I own an 80-acre farm in Brainerd, which is how I started farm to school in the central Minnesota region. I'm also the executive director of a nonprofit food hub, Sprout, located in Little Falls. And I would like to say hello to my neighbor, Representative Poston. Businesses such as mine would benefit from this bill because farm to school benefits local economies, keeping our food dollars local and increasing community health outcomes, strengthening eating habits from our youth by getting them out on into the farms and then teaching them about local foods and why local foods benefits their health. Extension coordinators positioned to assist farmers in providing technical assistance would take that load off of food hub staff such as myself, which dedicate a high amount of time and dollars to providing training to growers on how to compete with broadline distributors. Our food hub is located in Little Falls, has three full-time employees, licensed kitchens to continue processing our local foods in a value-added capacity. Its location was chosen specifically due to its highway trunk location in order to move more local foods to local school districts in central Minnesota. We are currently working with seven districts, not seven schools, seven districts, impacting over 12,000 school-aged children. We are working with over 70 small family farms, moving over 50,000 pounds each year of locally produced commodities into our school districts. Many of our growers indicate that farm-to-school purchases alone have increased their bottom-line family revenue of 5 to 10% over a year. That's significant when you're talking about small family farms who are living on $35,000 a year or less. Farm-to-school is successful because of our champions like Rachel, a food service director who will be testifying after I. Without policy structure, if we lose our food service champions like we did in the Brainerd District, we lose our successes in farm to school. Policy structure is our only way forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have from the Hmong Farmers Association, I believe. Go ahead, ma'am.
Great. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of this committee. Good morning. And thank you for allowing me to speak this morning. My name is Paku Hang, and I am the executive director of the Hmong American Farmers Association. We are a new nonprofit. We work to train and uplift and support Hmong farmers. We work with over 128 small-scale farmers. They farm anywhere from 5 to 10-acre parcels around the first-ring suburbs in the metropolitan area. And we also run a food hub where we train Hmong farmers on food safety, post-harvest handling, how to write and how to enact a food safety plan. And then we also work with them to find other markets besides the farmers market to sell their produce. I'm here today, obviously, to speak in favor of this bill, and they're really three main reasons that I want to speak to. The first one is that price matters. A couple of years ago, there was a study that was done by Joanne Bergenkamp, who was at that time at the IATP, at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. And she was talking to a bunch of schools to see if they would be interested in buying from local farmers. And there was great interest, but there was a little bit of a hesitation because the price for the fair price for local food often tended to be higher than prices for food that's grown in other places and a large scale. And so schools are very committed, but they wanted that a little bit of extra help. And I think there's provision in this bill that would allow for that extra help to support these schools. Secondly, I wanted to talk about multiplier effect. Over and over, there's been studies that said that if you you make a dollar investment, a $1 investment in farm to school, you get as much back as $2.28. And so, you know, we often think about farm to school as good social programs, but they're also really good economic programs, especially in rural communities. And then thirdly, I wanted to talk about how programs like farm to school can really support the pipeline for more farmers and to make farmers more productive. And what do I mean by that? We know that in Minnesota, the average age for farmers is 65, you know, some say 67 years old. And we're not building a pipeline for younger folks to become farmers. But for beginning farmers, a program like Farm to School, a new market, can be very advantageous for them to just make it from year to year. I think about my own organization and the farmers that we work with. When HAFA started, we were only in one school and in one institution. And on average, our sales, our Hmong farmer sales were only about $5,000 in sales per acre. 6 years later, we're in 177 schools. our produce serves or is ingested, you know, eaten by 75,000 students in the both the metro area and the first ring suburbs, and we're in 45 institutions and retailers. And our farmers have seen a doubling in their income because of these alternative markets or additional markets. So this is the viability, this puts the viability of their, you know, of their livelihood. And not only that, but it allows that 1 acre to be much more productive because produce that is grown is actually is going to actually be sold to markets as opposed to sold to the farmers market, and then not everything sells and they come back and they throw it away. And lastly, I just wanted to conclude that we know that the last election, there's a lot of talk about the urban or rural divide. And I think that a bill like this is wonderful because it's that ambassador. It can be that bridge to urban issues and rural issues. Everybody has a school that they care about. Everybody cares about their kids and what their kids are eating. And this is a program that speaks to everybody, whether they live in Minneapolis or they live in Virginia, Minnesota. So I urge you to support this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And next we have Rachel Valisano. Is she here? Or Matt Meyer, go ahead. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. It's an honor to be here in front of you. I feel like I was uniquely prepared.
You should identify yourself.
Oh, I'm Matt Meyer. I'm the president of Thousand Hills Cattle Company, which is a grass-fed beef company serving retailers and restaurants in the region. I've also worked for 25 years helping food manufacturers market their food to school food service operations nationally. So I have some insight as to the difficulty of addressing that market and the need for additional resources to help enter that market. Also, I moved back to the family farm that I was raised on about 10 years ago and began to raise grass-fed beef, so I'm a family farmer as well. In regards to the bill and the financial resources to help with the school meals, the nickel really does matter, if you're wondering about that. And there's an economic value of purchasing local. That's been addressed as far as, in our instance, it's staff at our company, but also processing in Cannon Falls and trucking and distribution. The local dollars really do spread out throughout the community in an impactful way. But in addition to that, when we just get down into, okay, how do you spend that nickel and what do you get back for it? The real benefit that I see is the nutritional value of the local food, whether it's produce grown locally and cared for locally or protein. And I'm going to talk specifically about protein. I'm going to talk about the hot dog. Okay, so the hot dog, not to offend anybody, is probably one of the lower forms of protein that you can get, and it's served in school meals. Our hot dog that we produce with 100% grass-fed beef has cost more on the input. We don't have the scale of a large manufacturer. We process in a year what they process in a shift, so we don't have scale economics. But what we really gain is the nutritional value to the students. Quick math, our hot dog will cost 50 cents to a school, and we're competing against one that costs 15 cents, 1-5. So in one meal offering, we can go from what probably is one of the lower nutritional value items on the menu to one that does not have preservatives, does not have nitrates or nitrites. I'm not trying to sell you. I'm just saying in the process, it takes longer to take out those preservatives and enter in the inputs, the grass-fed beef, in our instance, that makes that product nutritionally dense. So that investment in that environment, we see it as our local charity, really, to sell to schools, because we feel like we're having such an impact on that daily meal. And in our bid system that's set up in schools, we're constantly driving the cost down, and the manufacturers are constantly looking at how can they produce the product cheaper to meet that bid system. So we have a natural mechanism to drive down the nutritional value and the cost of the food going into school meals. And I think we should you know, as a society, look at that a little bit differently as to the majority of the food that a lot of students receive in a day happens at school, breakfast, lunch, and sometimes after school. So we kind of have competing objectives there on how we care for these children in school. So that's really, you know, where I see the value in this product and this dollars going into the school meals. Right now, we serve about a dozen districts in the state. Minneapolis and St. Paul happen to be leaders in public schools in looking at products locally grown, and we're very happy to play along with them and help to improve the school meals.
Mr. Meyer, where is your farm or ranch located?
By Clearwater.
Oh.
Monticello, Clearwater.
Very good. Any questions from committee members? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, Rachel.
All right, good morning. I'm Rachel Valisano. I am the school nutrition director for Owatonna Public Schools. I'm also a registered and licensed dietitian, so I have a great passion for the health of our students in our district and across, of course, our great state of Minnesota. I've been the director there for over 9 years, and our department is really passionate about our work. Owatonna, for those of you that are not familiar with, is located about an hour south of the Twin Cities. And we are a district of almost 5,000 students. We have 7 schools, and about 42% of our children are approved for free or reduced price meals. And we really have great participation in both our breakfast and lunch program district-wide. We serve about 5,000 meals each school day, majority of those coming in the form of lunch, but we also have a strong breakfast program as well. We've been serving local foods for a number of years, really since the time I began with the district, so for 9 years, and those foods are served to, of course, all district students as often as we can, sourcing both locally grown produce as well as locally raised meats, proteins. We've worked with several farmers over the years, from our local apple orchard in Ellendale to Ferndale Turkey Farm in Cannon Falls, and also have purchased a lot of Minnesota-grown produce throughout through our mainline distributor as well as our produce distributor. Distributors have really come a long ways in the local foods movement and are helping schools to help us meet this passion that we have for serving locally grown foods. So just some data, some statistics from our school district. Over the course of this school year to date, we've purchased about 4,100 pounds of local produce, or nearly $10,000 worth of items, anything from corn on the cob, zucchini, green beans, green peppers, cucumbers, watermelon, acorn squash, kohlrabi, so lots of variety. And then also over the course of the school year, we've purchased nearly 12,000 pounds of local turkey products in the form of ground turkey, turkey roasts, as well as turkey hot dogs. And that comes to about $22,000. So I'm thinking by the end of the school year, we'll be probably at around $50,000 in local food purchases. And we really have a lot of fun with trying some of that local protein in a variety of ways, whether it's using that ground turkey in our Sloppy Joes. We still serve good old Minnesota hot dishes like tater tot hot dishes. We actually had Representative Jasinski down in our district for a site visit a month ago, and he actually on that very day got to experience our made-from-scratch tater tot hot dish with our locally purchased ground turkey. So that was a fun day for us to have him in our district to see our program. Farm to school programs have continued to grow across our state for a number of years. We have a lot of school nutrition directors like myself that are very passionate about providing locally grown foods, both for the health of our students as well as the health, of course, of our local economies. However, this focus can come, as you've heard from others, at a higher cost. You know, just simply from the fact that staff time can be increased when it comes to trying to find farmers, trying to coordinate orders, deliveries, things of that nature. Our programs are very complex. As you maybe could imagine, USDA programs are really complicated, and we're required to be self-supporting within our school districts, so that means our fund is separate from the the general fund, and so we are responsible for all expenses from labor to food to fixing equipment, et cetera. So this bill could really, really help propel further our local purchases in our district as well as many others across the state. And the extra money that this bill would provide would also allow us to expand the number of farmers that we purchase from, which, of course, equals that we're going to serve additional high-quality local foods as well as help to educate kids, which is really what we're all about, whether it's in the classroom or in the lunchroom. The lunchroom, we believe, is an extension of the classroom. And so we need to help kids know where their food comes from. Many adults don't know where their food comes from. And so if we start at the lowest level with our kiddos, I think we can make a great difference in their eating habits for a lifetime. And then for schools across our state that haven't maybe made that leap yet, this bill would definitely incentivize them to make that leap and to begin a farm-to-school program. A lot of times, again, it starts small with those local apples, for example, is an easy place to start. So we would really greatly appreciate your support in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Sal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you made any progress at all in the consumability of all of the different kinds of food with younger children? I've got grandchildren at 3, 4, 8, and 12. And so I know that in that spectrum, some of them don't even want to be in the same room as a raw carrot. And so you have a unique challenge in that regard. Yes, you have a passion for what are the analytical reasons to have them, but what's the issue of how you get them, to get some uptake?
And so, Sam, go ahead.
Thank you.
I want to hear why you're feeling kohlrabi. Yeah.
I know. It takes time, I guess, is what I would say. I think back to when I started in Owatonna, even something like a black bean, for example, or exactly kohlrabi. It takes a lot of time, a lot of exposure. It's important to be able to do things like taste testing for kids. And I know in our district and many other districts across the state, we offer so much variety in any given day that students are naturally going to gravitate to something that they do enjoy. But I think another component that I didn't speak to during my testimony that this bill would really help with is that technical assistance that I know in our district and many districts we struggle with from that nutrition education component. In any given school year, my opinion, nutrition education, there's not nearly enough in our students' day. And so I think that if we can have more support or technical assistance from, like, extension coordinators, they can, I think, help provide more of that education link and, spend more time with kids, teaching them about, why is this food good for us? I do not typically like to use the words like healthy because oftentimes, again, whether we're a child or an adult, our natural tendency is to cringe at, I don't want to eat healthy food, but to really focus on because it's not going to taste good is, of course, the misconception, but to really focus on, why is it important to eat these different foods and to engage kids in the process. So someone referenced school gardens. Those hands-on activities. We've had some school gardens in our district over the year, and that it's amazing. It's really fun. In the summertime, we do summer meal programs, and we'll take those foods that those students have grown over the course of the summer and fold them into our meal program. And you should just see the buy-in from, of course, those kids that have helped grow that food. And telling their friends that maybe didn't have the opportunity to work in the garden about how great this tastes. And so it's not easy. It takes time, but it's possible for support that we have.
Very good. Thank you. Question? Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question. I just have a statement. When I'm not here in St. Paul and I'm back home, I'm in the restaurant and catering business, and we have had a long-time relationship with Arlene and the farm on St. Matthias just outside of Brainerd and with Sprout. Hi, neighbor. Okay. And over the years, our menus have changed a lot through buying local and have gotten healthier and healthier and healthier. So from farm to fork, this has been really successful for us. our customers really appreciate the local food, the healthier food, and I think the local food, healthier food is a great thing for our schools. Just wanted to make that comment.
Very good. Anybody in the audience care to testify on the bill? If not, final comments, Representative?
Mr. Chair, did I miss it or did we forget to amend the bill?
I didn't know you had an amendment.
Do you not have it?
It's not in my packet. Anybody? Was it substantial?
No, it really isn't, but maybe it's going to be heard in Ag Finance tomorrow. Is it possible to just amend it there? Or do we need to do it here?
Could be a problem. Is there any way we could... Mr. Sullivan, you to the rescue here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Keel, I believe I know the language of the amendment you're referring to. And it would be on House File 2049, page 3, line 3, your eligible uses. The amendment would delete the words a public school and insert an eligible recipient. And in my opinion, that's a technical fix to a drafting error in the bill as introduced.
So that was the amendment, Mr. Sullivan, as you recall?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
I would be okay with that, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Sullivan, could you repeat what we're deleting out?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, on page 3, line 3, delete the words a public school and insert an eligible recipient.
Are we okay with that, Representative?
No, I just...
Thank you very much. We were just handed a paper copy of it, but I think this amendment is a purely technical. Representative Bly, are you okay with it? Okay, thank you very much. So, again, page 3, line 3, the language is an eligible recipient. Is that your wish, Representative Keel?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Does anybody need any further explanation?
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is, who would be an eligible recipient other than a public school?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Clark. Johnson, excuse me. I should know better by now. I apologize.
There are some definitions.
Yes, there are definitions on...
page 1, I think.
Page 1, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And really, honestly, what it's intending to do is include both public and private schools, secondary schools, and child care providers. They have to also belong to or participate in the federal child nutrition program to qualify. So it would be daycares, child care centers. Okay. So it's intended for all.
Any final comments?
No.
So, Representative Mahoney, would you care to renew your file for the bill as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to renew my motion that House File 2040...
Hang on. We didn't vote on the amendment. I'm sorry. On the oral amendment. Would you move the oral amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the oral amendment on page 3.
All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Now, Representative, would you care to...
I'd like to renew my motion to move House File 2049 to the Committee on Ag Finance.
Thank you. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion passes as amended. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Next up, we have House File 1120.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 1120. Representative Polston, would you care to move the...
Yes, Mr. Bill. Sure. I move that House File 1120 be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture Finance.
right, and sounds like there's an author's amendment. Representative Swazinski, would you like someone to move the author's amendment at this time?
Yes, Chair Pearson, I appreciate that being moved and incorporated in the bill so we can get it in the shape that we'd like.
Mr. Chair, I move H1120A1 amendment be moved.
Discussion to the amendment? All those in favor of the H1120A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say nay. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Swazinski, please present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Pearson. Thank you, AG committee members. Appreciate this opportunity to come before you and speak about a great opportunity for the state of Minnesota. You know, shrimp, they may be small in animal agriculture, but let me assure you, shrimp have a big opportunity to make a big impact on the economies of Minnesota when it comes to animal agriculture. Today I have opportunity to introduce the committee, a company and a project that I think will really redefine what it means to be animal agriculture in rural Minnesota and in the metro as well. It has an opportunity to generate over tens of millions of dollars in economic viability within our communities and give really Minnesota a jump start when it comes to this industry across the country and really across the globe with some innovators that are homegrown Minnesotans and keep this industry right here in Minnesota. I'm going to let my testifiers really tell you a lot about what the future holds for this industry. I want to, from Relco and True Shrimp, they're two businesses that are from my neck of the woods down in southwest Minnesota. I first want to introduce you to Brian Nakamas, who's the president of Relco in Ballaton, Minnesota, and also Michael Zabel. He's the general manager of True Shrimp Systems. This is a good opportunity. Appreciate the time before the committee, and we're going to learn a lot about what shrimp can mean to Minnesota. And I'm sure we look forward to answering some questions once we get along. And I think one point before we get started, Representative Poston really made a good point when with the last bill before us, and he talked about local food and healthy food. And really that's the point of this industry, and that's really the genesis of why we think this is so important for us to really take this on and grab a shrimp by its tail and get this thing going. So thank you very much.
And go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Brian Nakamas. I'm the president and CEO of Relco out of Marshall. It's my great pleasure to give you a little background on how we got here. Relco is a 45-year-old company based out of Marshall, Minnesota, and our core areas of interest have been perfecting technologies in areas of animal health, animal nutrition, and soil and plant health and nutrition productivity as well. And for 45 years, we've been doing that successfully here in Minnesota, domestically throughout the U.S. and internationally as well. And a little background on the endeavor of shrimp, how we got there. I was actually in Ecuador 9 or 10 years ago, working with some shrimp farmers down there relative to a feed ingredient that we had to help them be more productive in their pond systems. And I was introduced through that activity to Texas A&M University and Dr. Addison Lawrence, where they were developing a land-based shrimp production system, of which became a patented system out of Texas A&M, and Texas A&M licensed the technology to Relco in the effort to commercialize this technology for commercialized production of land-based shrimp production. So we've been working at it. We knew that this would take significant investment in both people and resources. We built an innovation and a pilot center in Ballaton, Minnesota, that will truly rival any shrimp research facility in the world. If any of you would care to come down and visit us personally and see that facility, we'd love to have you. But I just wanted to reiterate our commitment to Minnesota. We are a Minnesota-based company. We would love to see this industry develop and thrive in Minnesota and feel that this bill would be a critical part to that. And lastly, just to give a little bit of an update, which Mr. Zabel will give you a more comprehensive update, but we have effectively proven scientifically that this technology does work. We can grow shrimp in Minnesota, actually to compete very well, very, very well with shrimp production on a world scale. So, Mr. Chair and representatives, I again thank you for the opportunity that we have to bring more awareness to this issue and hopefully get you excited about shrimp in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And you have another testifier there. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Zabel. I have the privilege of being the general manager of True Shrimp Systems and represent the team that has been working on this technology for the last 2 years. Brian used the word, and the word is industry. I think when I started out on this project, I was thinking about building a shrimp business. But it became very apparent to me and all of us that we were actually building an entire industry. It is our intention to build a fully integrated industry from the raw ingredients, from the young shrimp, all the way to the table. And we're going to use a classic and proven integrated model that is used today across the poultry, swine, and other industries. And basically the concept is called the hub and spoke. And in the middle, the hub will be the centers of excellence. There will be genetics, hatchery, nutrition, veterinary sciences, microbiology, also processing and sales and marketing in that hub. And that hub will be in the concert with multiple harbors. We call a shrimp production facility a harbor. And we're not trying to be cute there. We want to separate ourselves completely from the rest of the world and the way they produce shrimp. Today, the United States market for shrimp is 1.6 billion pounds. That's 5 pounds for every man, woman, and child in America. And if you didn't get your 5 pounds, don't worry about it. I got it. Okay? But 80% of that shrimp is imported into the United States. The vast majority of it comes from Southeast Asia and Ecuador, and what's on the screen gives you an idea of the primitive conditions under which shrimp are raised. It's largely a coastal industry. They develop ponds right on the coast. They pump the water out of the ocean into the ponds, and they fill the ponds with young shrimp, or what's called post larvae. And the significance of these ponds, of course, in the last several decades, they have been just devastated by disease. And their only methodology for really combating the disease is huge amounts of antibiotics. They dump the antibiotics right into the water, hoping that that'll cure the shrimp. And our system, what Brian alluded to, its technical name is a super intense shallow water raceway, but we call it a tidal basin. And effectively, the technology is about shallow water. Shrimp ponds across the world are 3 meters or more deep. Our shrimp live at an average depth of 12 inches of water. So we are in far better control of the environment of the shrimp. And then we have systems that are related to the tidal basin that carry the waste away. The uneaten feed, the fecal matter, the molts is all carried away. So unlike the ponds, the shrimp never live in their own waste. The waste is constantly carried away. In the presentation there, you can see a picture of our production tidal basins that we have in the Innovation Center that Brian alluded to. This has been a science-based effort, and make no mistake of that. From the very beginning, we have looked at this, and we have to validate this process. We have to statistically understand how does this work. And this graph demonstrates that over the last several months, our progress and our success has done nothing but accelerate. To the point today that we can grow a 35-gram shrimp, and those of you trying to figure out what that is, that's a 16 to 20-count shrimp. It's a big one. We can grow one of those shrimps in less than 140 days in our technology. And on behalf of the team that works on it, Dr. John Holt and his staff, every cohort, every new group of shrimp that comes in, we are improving upon that. We will put these shrimp in what we call a harbor. And a harbor is a very large building. It's 9 acres under one roof. There are 256 of our tidal basins, and one of the redeeming features of our technology. Because of shallow water, we can stack the tidal basins on top of one another and therefore use the land more efficiently. Annually, we will grow 153 million shrimp or 7 million pounds of shrimp. To give you a point of reference, the entire shrimp aquaculture industry today in the United States, as measured by the USDA, is only 11.3 million pounds. Two of our harbors will exceed the current production of the United States. And our 35-gram shrimp in 140 days. We have to feed these 75 million shrimp every day. And we'll need 15 million pounds of feed. And that feed is made up of soybeans and grains. And we have successfully, we're the first ever to feed corn to shrimp in any sort of amount. We're up to 300 pounds in every ton of feed. It's a significant thing. Over 45% today of the shrimp's diet is soybean or soybean derivatives, concentrates and such. So when people ask us, why Minnesota? Why would you do that here? The answer is really simple. This is where the feed is. This is where the raw materials are to grow the shrimp. You'll see in a moment here, we commissioned the University of Minnesota to do an economic impact study on what we are attempting to do. And they came back regarding feed that they projected that one of our harbors could increase the average price of a bushel of soybeans by 5 to 15 cents, which I thought was an astronomical number. That study that I was telling you about, the University of Minnesota Extension Service did this for us. We commissioned them to do it. They estimated that just the building of our harbor would have a $48 million contribution to a five-county area. They happen to use the counties that we live in, but any five counties in Minnesota. 330 people, their employment will be touched by the building of this harbor, and over $14 million of labor income from the building of the harbor. Then they went on, and they went and studied the ongoing operation of this harbor year in and year out, and they came back that the annual economic contribution of one harbor, and one harbor alone, would be $30 million a year. It would impact the employment of over 109 people in the area, and the direct and indirect impact would be 124 people with a economic or a income, personal income of over $6 million. So the opportunity here to build this business in Minnesota has a significant economic impact. That doesn't include, and right now the University of Minnesota is working on the economic impact of the hub, and what will that bring? And that will be, of course, our own research, our pilot center, which we are making plans now to expand. We have to build hatcheries. Shrimp are marine animals. They live in salt water, and they spawn like fish. We have to have a hatchery to be able to collect that spawn. We intend to build a genetic facility so that we can find the right families of shrimp that will thrive in our environment. We're going to build a processing facility. In fact, our working plan right now is we have a memo of understanding for a vacant USDA plant in Marshall, and we estimate that when we're fully operational, that will employ 60 people to run the processing. In addition to that, we'll have a sales and marketing organization. And there's one other thing that we are studying with this. Those of you who've eaten shrimp and you've had the pleasure of pulling the shell off, you threw the shell away. You shouldn't have done that. That shell is extremely valuable. It's got a compound in it called chitin, and it's a natural polymer, and that can be further processed into a natural polymer called chitosan. And that chitosan is used across a multitude of industries. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. But we have something unique. Because we control the habitat of the shrimp, because we control their nutrition, because we trace them through every step of the process, our chitosan from our shells or molts, as we call them, can be used for medical and medical device purposes. They are described by a biotech industry as absolutely pristine. We're just starting on this. Every once in a while, I have to remind everybody we're in shrimp business here, not chitosan, but it's very exciting. Another industry for us to pursue. I'm very proud to say that this has been a Minnesota effort. Not only Ralco and the team that worked with the Pentera Minnesota Company, helps us with our equipment needs, pumps and such. We have a company in Marshall called Action Track, Track Chairs, and of course they're famous for their building and their innovation of track chairs for disabled people. They are building the robotic feeders for us and have built the prototypes that are operating. Sealy is a plastics company here in the Twin Cities that supported us. We have an engineering company, HMI. New Vision Co-op in southern Minnesota has been our partner to develop the shrimp feed. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Novatech. Novatech's in Wilmer, Minnesota, and they are famous for their debeaking and decaling of poultry across the world. And they have taken on the challenge of building state-of-the-art, brand-new processing equipment for shrimp. And that may sound like a big deal to you, but there is no machine anywhere in the world to take the head off of shrimp. It's all done by hand after the shrimp have aged or sat in the sun for a while. Okay? We're not going to do it that way. And a month ago, they brought the prototype to our research facility and absolutely stunned us. They have figured out how to efficiently cut the head off of a shrimp. And now they're moving on to getting that shell off so we can make it into dice. Okay? Why 69 cents real quickly? 69 cents is the mitigation of the risk. Okay? And the risk lies in the fluctuation of the price of shrimp. So that 69 cents relates to the fluctuation from the average price to the lowest price ever recorded in a three-year period. So that's the background behind that. Why should you do this? I know you've got lots of demands in front of you. I'd like to give you my pitch. We're going to build a completely new industry in Minnesota. It will not compete with any other industry, and it builds on the commodities and adds value to the commodities that we already produce. We have developed and validated the technology, as Brian said, beyond the shadow of a doubt. We are pursuing this. We have a chance here in Minnesota to absolutely dominate shrimp aquaculture with this technology. Nowhere in the world has something like this ever been done. We're going to consume millions of pounds and tons of Minnesota commodities. We're going to create and retain hundreds and someday thousands of jobs and employment opportunities in Minnesota. And I do say Minnesota. We're from southwestern Minnesota, but the harbor can be as far as 8 hours away. And we can still take care of it. So we can put harbors on the Iron Range, harbors in the east, harbors to the north. And it certainly would benefit rural outstate development. And what I'm asking you, what we're asking you with this bill, is to encourage this investment. It's a variable expense. The way the bill is written, the way it's crafted, it doesn't cost the state of Minnesota anything until we start producing lots and lots of shrimp. And by the time we produce that shrimp, the investment's been made, the labor is in place, the market has been approached with that. So there's tax benefits and lots of benefits for the state of Minnesota for years to come. And as far as local food, I couldn't wait any longer. I went to talk to a Twin Cities, a major retailer in Twin Cities, and it was a very typical buyer call. If you've ever met a salesman, what are you here for? What do you want? What do you got to sell? And by the time I left, he had his arm around me and say, I want exclusivity for the Twin Cities. Because we have solved the problems. We've solved the problem of no antibiotics. Everything we do is natural. We have solved a significant problem, and that is traceability. The shrimp industry today, that bag of shrimp that you buy may say product of Vietnam. There's no way that can be tracked to any sort of accuracy. We'll be able to track our shrimp right back to the day they were spawned. So I ask you to help us build this industry in Minnesota. We're very excited for what the opportunity will bring. Thank you for your attention, Eddie.
Thank you, Mr. Isabella, for your testimony. And we have a question from Representative Nornes.
Not really a question, I guess. I don't eat a lot of seafood, but I've kind of developed an interest in shrimp. Kind of recent. But I was going to say, I was at Wilmer a couple years ago at the invitation of AORI. I believe they were the sponsor, or at least they were involved with a presentation just about like the one you just gave us.
I was there, sir.
Yes. And I was very impressed, again, with the whole concept. And Fergus Falls would be very, very welcome to have a couple of shrimp move in. So just keep us in mind.
About $75 million.
Representative Polster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you can see, I do get my share of shrimp, just like you. I'm just going to make a comment from a restaurant standpoint. Like I said earlier, I'm in the restaurant business when I'm not here, and I continually tell our executive chef to add more shrimp to our menus, and he continually tells me, no, I can't do that because it's not available and it's not good, healthy shrimp. So I'm really excited about this. Looking forward to it moving forward.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. We've heard lots of good and positive things about your proposal. Another resource that you'll be using, and I'd just like some assurance about how it will be used, and it's in an area where there are concerns about this resource, and that resource is water. Can you tell us, are you going to be recycling water, or how are you going to deal with the water?
Mr. Zabel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for that question. Water, of course, is critical to what we're doing, and it is a marine animal, so we have to turn the water into salt water. And one of our harbors will have one or more complete wastewater treatment plants on the premises. It is in our interest to recycle that water. We'll have money invested in it to RO it and to put salt in it. And so a typical harbor, for example, will take 14 million gallons of water to fill it up. But that takes place actually over the first year. We stagger start the harbor. So it takes 14 million gallons. But once that 14 million gallons is in there, we intend to recycle every drop of water that we can. We anticipate we will need between 60 and 100,000 gallons a day certainly to take care of the human beings that are in there. And also, we will lose some water through evaporation. But to give you a point of reference, that's about the amount of water it takes to water a golf course. So water conservation and water availability, even as we look to place these harbors, we're going to study that very carefully, because in no way do we want to jeopardize the community. That's not the idea here. So we'll be good stewards of the water, I assure you. It's in our best economic interest to do that as well.
Representative Blatt?
I'm pleased to hear that. I guess I'm not sure when you're initially extracting that water to use it, what the effect will be. And has that been studied at all?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee? Yes, it has. In fact, for example, today, two of the locations that we are studying is Marshall itself, our home, and Laverne, Minnesota. And that's the number one question: what is the supply of water like? Is there more than enough? For example, Laverne, Minnesota is on the Lewis and Clark system there, and they have enough water. And Marshall has just brought more wells online. So that, and we would work with the municipality to bring that water into the harbor and to manage that.
Representative Blatt?
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for the author, so that I understand, and it's a finance, so you may not have the answer today, but I am kind of wondering, is this a 5-year subsidy or an 11-year subsidy? It's just kind of confusing to me, because this will join the finance tomorrow.
Representative Swazinski. Thank you, Chair Pearson. Representative Mahoney. So if you look, it really depends on when they come online. So the entire life of it would be, I believe, 11 years. But the access to it would be 5. So as a harbor would come online, or as a production facility would come online, their opportunity to access that would be 5 years. If you think of it as a staggered operation where you would bring one on, that would have a 5-year opportunity, and so on. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
You answered a number of the questions with the water that I had. I got 3 questions here. So what are the wages that you're looking at for your line workers? One of the things that many times in the Economic Development Committees we hear is people come in and go on average or median income. And what they do is they take the chief executive and the lowest paid and they average them all out. And the chief executive always brings it up to $14 or $16 or $20 an hour. When the real wage on the line is $12 an hour. So what's your line worker, what's your business plan call for in a line worker's salary or hourly wage, I'm going to guess?
Mr. Zabel, would you like to answer that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members of the committee. In our modeling, so in our business plan, we have the line workers at $15 with full benefits.
Representative Mahoney.
Full benefits being health and retirement and some of the other things?
Mr. Zabel.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
One other question, this may go to finance, and if the chair wants me to, I can ask it tomorrow. But you mentioned that you took, when you figured 69 cents, you took the high and the low of the value of shrimp, the cost of shrimp. Are we subsidizing, I don't know what the cost of shrimp is a pail, because you really don't want to see what happens to me when I eat shrimp. They're shellfish, period. So I had no idea what shrimp would cost at the grocery store or anyplace else. But let's say your shrimp is selling for $1 a pail, the high end. Do you still get the 69 cents at that high end by this bill? And that might be to the author of the bill. I don't know which one would answer that one.
Well, Mr. Zabel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, when you think about this, the way we established the transfer price from the harbor to the processing facility, we use a syndicated research service called Urneberry. Urneberry is a worldwide syndicated service that tracks the price of commodities across the entire world. Okay? And one of the commodities that they track is shrimp. And in our modeling, sir, we use a three-year average of the value of the shrimp by size. Well, the shrimp has a different value. The bigger they get, the greater the value. The 69 cents is a point in time where the average value of that shrimp compared, that three-year average compared to the low, the absolute low price in that three-year period. So it's designed to mitigate the risk for the investors. That's what it does.
If
I answer your question.
Well, this is finance, but I'll ask it a different way. So is it always 69 cents no matter where the market is? Is it always 69 cents?
Mr. Zabel, excuse me.
Mr. Chairman.
I almost demoted you to a representative, sorry.
So long as you don't call him a senator.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Mr. Zabel.
Yes, the way the model is built, it's all the 69 cents. And that three-year average will move up and down. I don't want you to think about it that it's moving violently in any given day. It moves together. Up and down.
Representative Swazinski. Thank you. And it will also be prorated. So if we get to a point where, the allotted funds are being exceeded by the application for that 69 cents, that money will not just cut off after it gets expended. Those dollars will be disseminated equally.
Saw that.
Representative Mahoney.
One other question. And this was a surprise to me. It came up in, I think Representative Anderson asked a question about heating. It was in jobs yesterday, heating urban agriculture. And are you heating this particular, I saw the picture, it's a fairly substantial building. Are you heating the building, just heating the water, and how are you planning on doing that? That's a fairly substantial piece, a lot of cost to it.
Mr. Zabel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we actually heat the water. The shrimp live in 86 degree Fahrenheit water. And as daunting as that sounds, once we have 14 million gallons of water up to 86 degrees, and the entire superstructure that entails that, the thermal heat from that, it is not as daunting as I think it might be. Today our models, we use natural gas to heat the water, to heat the facility. One of the things that we're looking at, and we really want to do this, look to alternative energy sources. We are in conversation with an ethanol plant, for example, and they have enough excess steam to heat the entire harbor. We're looking at methane from Santa landfills. So we are looking for alternatives, but it is not as daunting as you think. Even in our research center, the boilers barely ever run, even in the dead of winter.
And, Mr. Chair, one last comment. As you're talking to a pipe fitter, you probably should have mentioned solar thermal. Just
comment. Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Isabel.
My mistake.
Representative Anderson? If we have time. Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, shrimp has a market. It's a commodity. And with the type of production you're talking about, a large production, I can see one of two things happening. Either the per capita consumption of shrimp is going to go up or the price of shrimp is going to come down. Do you anticipate any kind of major changes or, again, with the state subsidy or whatever you want to call it, how would that affect? Is the state subsidy locked in, or in case the price of shrimp comes down because of oversupply, for example?
Mr. Zabel?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one of our harbors, as big as it sounds, 7 million pounds, is 0.37% of the entire U.S. market for shrimp. We don't anticipate having an impact on the shrimp market itself for some time. And if anything, we're going to drive the price of shrimp up slightly because of the quality of our product. We're a long ways from impacting the national or even international market for shrimp. We have to, and hopefully that by that time, 10 years from now, we would have had enough harbors in place to be productive. But we have so many benefits to this in terms of how the consumer will look at this product. We actually think that we will enhance the price of shrimp. It will be a premium product for some time to come.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. This is interesting to me, of course. My question is, you talked about the waste from the water. There's a waste product. You talked about a large amount of water, and you talked about salt water, which makes me think that the DNR and the MPCA would be interested in this operation. Have you investigated the permits that you would need to do this and investigated the challenges associated with protection of water, amount of water, that stuff?
Mr. Zabel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for that question. Yes, we have. Certainly when we started with our Innovation Center in Dalton, we engaged the DNR and the MPCA. And also we've had the commissioner of both of those agencies at our facility with the Minnesota Business First and discussed that with them. There's certainly going to be challenges. There's certainly going to be a negotiation. But because we are in such control of the water and the fact that we want to recycle it, we think we can overcome their objectives. We're very confident we can, as they were.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And are there any issues that we should know about at this point in time before we go further, as this bill comes forward? Have any issues come up that look challenging that it would be, the responsible thing would be to make sure we know about those challenges going ahead?
I would anticipate the investors have asked those questions pretty thoroughly as well, but Mr. Isabel?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, to my knowledge, no, sir.
Thank you.
We have a lot of work to do yet, but we can't see any challenges.
Representative Salt.
Just a quick question. I think when I go buy shrimp, there's kind of this spectrum of quality having to do with something as unique as just plain taste. So is there a way that, and you mentioned speed of growth, and it's sort of like the twinkle of your eye and the throughput toward profitability factors that start to kick in, where the business is going to drive itself toward speed more than maybe maintaining quality, because some things like the taste of shrimp actually degrade at speed is my thinking. Now maybe you've got genetics and or systems that modify for that factor. Thank you.
Mr. Zabel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've been in the food business my entire professional career. It is our intention to make this the best tasting, best texture, best shrimp the world has ever seen, and we will not sacrifice the quality of the product for our speed. The speed that we've achieved has been done through nutrition, and it's also been done through husbandry, our management of the water habitat. Our shrimp tastes delicious. And the variation that you see, ladies and gentlemen, is really from the handling. They are so terribly handled in that importation process that none of that will take place in our system. Our system will be built on controlling all of that. They're sweet. They taste good. Even if you don't like shrimp, we could convert you, I think.
We do have a 12:15 session and a couple bills to get through yet here. So was there anyone else in the audience that would wish to testify? I found the conversation very interesting. If you had mentioned steak and shrimp, the cattlemen might not have left. But other than that, with that, I guess we'll have Representative Poston would like to renew his motion to that House File 1120 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Agriculture and Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Oh.
These next two will not take that long, I guarantee it. Next up on the bill is House File 1121. Representative Lulick, would you care to move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1121 be referred to Property Taxes and Local Government Finance Division.
Representative, please present your bill.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Appreciate the opportunity to bring 1121 before you. This simply because, you know, shrimp production is a brand new endeavor for the state of Minnesota, and it is animal agriculture. It simply works with the property tax purpose for allowing 2A A classification for shrimp aquaculture, kind of in the same manner that we would treat fish aquaculture.
Questions?
I'd appreciate your support.
Questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Lowick, could you refer your familiar motion?
I would renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
Any no final comments?
And that's going to property taxes, correct?
Yes. The motion, Representative Lowick, the motion 1121 will be referred to the Committee on Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Next bill up is House File 1655. Representative Lewick.
I would move House File 1655 be referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Representative Suzinski, please, let's hear about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1655, you know, addresses the uniqueness of the beginning of this endeavor that we're partaking for the state of Minnesota. Really looking at, from a sales tax perspective, on construction materials for the construction of the harbors and the processing facilities.
Representative members, Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Suzinski, I don't know if you know this, but hopefully somebody here knows. We do this with communities and, you know, local government units. Do we have precedents for sales tax exemptions for private business?
I think we do, Representative Suzinski.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe there is plenty of precedents. I believe last year we saw for the potential tax bill for facilities up in the Iron Range as well. I forget exactly what the facilities were incorporated in, but this is not a new endeavor.
Representative Mahoney.
We just did about a $35 or $40 million one last night in jobs for and sent it off to taxes for DGT. So
yeah,
we do it all the time.
And I thought about the Viking Stadium, but that isn't a private facility anymore.
But the soccer stadium, I believe, I think that's what you're talking about, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. But a good question. Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say this from Representative Mahoney, when you say we do this all the time, so there's a long history of this? We're talking a lot of projects that have been not considered in this session, but actually enacted in statute.
Representative Mahoney?
any project that's built in this state over 25, 30 million dollars gets sales tax exempts on all their building products. It's common practice.
Thank you.
It's one of the problems with America. We like to give tax breaks to businesses.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On House File 1655, would that include any other shrimp facilities that would be in Minnesota? So it's not restricted to the one that we previously have been talking about, but it would be, so if there's any shrimp facilities in the state of Minnesota that wanted to do some additional growth or building, they'd be allowed to use this exemption?
Representative Susan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, just taking a gander at the bill, we do have the definition section. So line 1.13 through 1.12, we talk about what is an aquatic shrimp farm, what is an aquatic shrimp farmer, and then the bottom, a shrimp processing facility. So that'd be primarily, so the primary use. I believe that we do not have a size constraint upon that.
Thank you.
I would agree, Representative, that this is a little bit open-ended.
Yes.
In that there's no ending date and no limit as to how much the exemption could be, like the one we looked at last night. But it is what it is. Any further questions from members on the bill? Anybody in the audience who would care to comment on the bill? If seeing no other comments, Representative Straczynski, any final comments?
Appreciate the opportunity to come before you today for all three bills. I'd appreciate the continued conversation as we hopefully bring these bills before us on the House floor and your continued support. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Lewick.
I would renew my motion that House File 1655 be referred to the Committee on Taxes.
All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The motion passes, and the bills are on their way.
With that, members, I think this may be it, but it's been a good committee, and the meeting is adjourned.